From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the president signed the long-awaited and much-debated campaign finance reform bill. But immediately after its passage, the media let fly a barrage of critical coverage as political columnists and pundits searched for loopholes and weak points in the legislation. In a recent article for Slate.com, USA Today columnist Walter Shapiro wrote that not since Elvis Presley went to the White House to enlist in Richard Nixon's war on drugs has a Washington event inspired so much cynicism as the passage of campaign finance reform. He says this resounding Bronx cheer can be traced to a single source.
I hate to be one of these people who has one-size-fits-all explanations, but I think a good chunk of it is that campaign consultants are the best sources of every political reporter. When you are looking to figure out what something that touches on politics means, you call your friends, the consultants. And on background, off the record, 80% of the consultants are devastatedly against campaign reform. And they will explain to you either how it will drive money from the pristine nature of the current system underground, how it will set off an avalanche of unintended consequences. But what nobody seems to pick up on is that campaign consultants, particularly media consultants, are not exactly disinterested observers of the passing scene. They are people who can lose money directly from the passage and the signing into law of McCain-Feingold.
Well, I'd like to explore the two points you raised. The first one being, from the journalist's perspective, do you really think it's a question of keeping their sources in their pockets that keeps them so dark and gloomy on campaign finance reform?
I know how the game works. You know, if you're trying to write about the outlook for the Senate elections, you call six consultants, three Democrats and three Republicans, and you assume that their opinions will balance themselves out. On campaign finance reform, five of them, or all six of them, will come up with new cynical explanations. So to some extent, you're a prisoner of your sources, in the sense, except for calling political science professors, or the another interview with John McCain, there are not too many voices you're talking to who talk about how this legislation will work. You know, I'm not saying the bill is, you know, handed down from Mount Sinai, but for someone who covered the 1996 Clinton fundraising scandals and has seen the way soft money has dominated politics ever since, it is a major step in the right direction.
Let's go to the second point, which is that all these sources that you say journalists are prisoners of stand to benefit from all the money that flows into elections.
Okay. Most people, even in Washington, are pretty naive about how campaign consultants make their money. They think that most consultants get the bulk of their money on a fee-for-service basis. Pollsters do generally get paid that way. But for media consultants, which is where the real money is, they get a percentage of the overall advertising buy, called an ad placement fee. This is a tradition borrowed from Madison Avenue. The more money that's put on television in a campaign, the larger the fee going to the media consultant and his team.
So how much money are we talking about?
Scads. It's very hard to know because Federal Election Commission rules don't reveal how much the consultants make. But there's one California gubernatorial campaign in 1998 where the losing candidate, Al Checchi, let his contracts be made public. And in that case, the media consultant and the pollster would have made $2.8 million. And this is just one of about 5 to 50 campaigns both were involved in that political cycle.
That's a lot of scratch. Is this new news, or is it widely known but little discussed in Beltway circles?
It is semi-unknown and virtually never discussed. There's sort of a rule of etiquette in Washington. It is really impolite to ask anyone, particularly a campaign consultant or a lobbyist, exactly how they earn their money and exactly how much do they make. And they are covered by a political press that makes them seem like they have no motivation in life other than their partisan identification as either a Democrat or a Republican. And that's nonsense.
Now, this isn't explicit in your article, but one could derive from what you wrote that since campaign strategists get paid a percentage of ad buys, that very fact could skew the whole system. I mean, TV ads are so expensive, the need to raise all that money drives the political process. What if the only reason that ad buys are so valued is that it enriches the strategists?
If you stop a media consultant, they will talk about the effectiveness of television. But the fact is that, for example, getting out the vote drives, voter education is an area where you cannot make money on. And the result is that in the last 20 years, there has been almost no volunteer presence in politics, and often television costs eat up 70 or 80% of the budget. At the same point, voters tend to be more and more turned off by campaigns, and there certainly has been no upsurge in voter turnout because they are so thrilled that the television ads bring them so much closer to true democracy.
Well, it was a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Walter Shapiro wrote the recent article, Campaign Reform's Real Losers, in Slate, and he is a columnist for USA Today.
On April 8th, the Pulitzer Committee will announce this year's awards for investigative journalism. Simply being considered for a Pulitzer Prize puts journalists and the papers they work at in an elite group, like the Academy Awards. And similar to this year's Oscars, the Pulitzers are currently the center of a really good fight. In one corner, the Seattle Times. The other corner, the Wall Street Journal. On the Media's Jad Abumrad has the call.
Last March, the Seattle Times published the six-part series Uninformed Consent. After a two-year investigation, the series concluded that doctors at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, called Hutch for short, did not adequately inform patients of the risks involved in the clinical trials they were a part of. Many patients died prematurely, according to the series. A year later, Uninformed Consent has won four major journalism awards, and the series is rumored to be a finalist for the Pulitzer. That's when the accusations started flying. Steve Goldstein, a spokesman for the Wall Street Journal, puts it bluntly.
With the evidence that the Seattle Times had, that story would not have passed muster in the Wall Street Journal.
So Journal managing editor Laura Landreau wrote an opinion piece entitled Good Medicine, Bad Journalism. Landreau, a cancer survivor, accused the Seattle Times of short-sighted sensationalism, of ignoring the number of lives the center's research has saved, including her own. That same day, the Seattle Times fired back with their own op-ed, Good Journalism, Bad Critique, about Landreau's piece.
There was absolutely nothing in her piece that undermined the validity of what we reported. She didn't even speak specifically to any of the details.
David Boardman is the editor of the series.
She's very connected with the place. They saved her life. So she's not an unbiased source.
Goldstein responds,
that's preposterous, and it's sexist. She is a professional journalist writing about a topic to which she's very knowledgeable about.
The op-ed tit-for-tat continued this week, mostly centered around the issue of timing. Why did the journal decide to publish Landreau's op-ed now versus a year ago? The Seattle Times contends, and the New York Times suggests, that the journal may have been trying to derail the series from getting a Pulitzer.
I see this as the latest chapter in a long and storied history of the controversy over the prizes.
Doug Bates, editor of The Oregonian and historian of the Pulitzer Prize, says the jury, which met a month ago to select the finalists, is supposed to keep the names secret till the board makes its decision in April.
But we people in the newspaper business are probably the biggest blabbermouths on earth.
Still, the hubbub within the industry rarely breaks through to the outside world, as it has this year. One notorious case— In 1981, Washington Post reporter Janet Cook was awarded a Pulitzer for profiling an 8-year-old heroin addict, a story she later admitted was completely made up. The prize was retracted. This concern for accuracy, normally a good thing between journalists, can become a weapon in the hands of private institutions who may use it to bludgeon even worthy Pulitzer Prize submissions, says Dave Boardman of the Seattle Times.
You know, this isn't about the Wall Street Journal trying to keep us from getting a Pulitzer. This is about the Hutch trying to keep us from getting a Pulitzer Prize.
According to Boardman, even before the Landrieu editorial was published, an association, of which the Hutch is the principal member, sent a packet of information the size of the Seattle phone book to the members of the Pulitzer board.
This kind of thing has been going on behind the scenes for some time.
Boardman recalls a similar situation with journalist Sam Rowe, now with the Chicago Tribune.
In 1999, when I was at my former paper, the Toledo Blade, we had published a 6-part series on beryllium, which is a metal used in nuclear weapons and whose toxic dust can cause an awful fatal lung disease.
Rowe's series provoked the ire of a Cleveland beryllium manufacturer.
And they started distributing a thick pack of materials, thick as a New York phone book, actually, and part of it was titled A Chronicle of Reckless Reporting. I honestly believe that they tried to intimidate the judges, not just the Pulitzer judges, but other contest judges, by the sheer volume of it.
The built-in problem, according to Rowe, is that the Pulitzer Board has limited time to evaluate not just newspaper submissions, but also encyclopedia-sized challenges, and that hurts a reporter's chances. Seymour Topping, director of the Pulitzer Committee, says that's not true. He declined to be taped for this interview, but he did say, adamantly, that the board resists lobbying. Pulitzer Prize historian Doug Bates.
There have been those kind of controversies throughout the history of the prizes in journalism. That doesn't mean that a close look at that history leaves you feeling that the prizes are badly tarnished, quite the opposite.
Except in a few unusual years, like this one.
It reminds me a lot of what happened this year in the Academy Awards.
Like Oscar winner or Olympic gold medalist, the phrase Pulitzer Prize winner will precede the name of the people who win it for the rest of their professional lives. Even in the most rarefied newsrooms, that's a distinction worth fighting for. For On the Media, this is Jad Abumrad.
Coming up, how to get noticed by Google, why the author of Primary Colors thinks Bill Clinton got a bad rap. Also, the FCC makes TV more accessible for the blind.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The internet search engine Google wound up in the middle of a religious spat last week. After receiving a letter from groups representing the Church of Scientology, Google briefly pulled the main page of Xenu.net, an anti-Scientology website, from their database until it could check out the church's claim that the site was in violation of copyright law. The claim turned out to be unfounded, and Xenu.net is once again popping up at number 4 in search results for the term Scientology. But both Xenu.net and the Church of Scientology have been battling for supremacy atop Google for a long time by using keen knowledge of how Google works to manipulate its results. It's not the first time, and certainly won't be the last, that people have tried to dupe search engines. Joining us now is Daniel Sullivan, the editor of SearchEngineWatch.com. Isn't it wonderful such a thing exists? Dan, welcome to OTM.
Hi, thank you very much.
So first, a primer on Google. What makes one website pop up ahead of another site in a search?
Well, there's no easy answer because Google uses a whole variety of factors. It looks at the words that are on the page, the location of the words that are on the page, how often they may appear. But it does give some extremely heavy weight to links across the web. And so a website that has a lot of links pointing at it may be deemed as more important than a website that has only a few. Or a website that has only a few links pointing at it may still be seen as very important if those links are from very important websites. So if the only links you got were from, let's say, Yahoo, CNN, and perhaps from NPR, even though you had only 3 links, those 3 websites are very important, and so that might be much better than having 50,000 links from people who have little tiny web logs.
So how were Xenu.net and the Church of Scientology battling it out to top each other when you search for the word Scientology on Google?
there was this suggestion that, in the case of ZDNet, that a lot of people started linking to the site to try to get it up there in the rankings. And in fact, I think that some of this linking that started to happen was one reason why it did pop up there.
Well, and if it's not being done for strictly informational purposes, that's called Google bombing, isn't it?
Google itself would tend to refer to that activity as link spam, which is the idea of creating artificial link structures to try to manipulate the results. And it can be a fine line, because if all these people are linking and they honestly believe this is a great site, then what they're doing may not actually be a bad thing.
What other kinds of maneuvers have websites pulled off in the past to get them higher in the search results?
Well, there's very basic things such as repeating a word over and over again. Some people would then hide those words by making them match the same color as the background page. A more advanced type of thing that would happen would be the creation of what's known as, say, doorway pages. And this is where you create a page that may not make any sense if you looked at it as a human being. It might look like a bunch of gibberish, but you've tried to concoct a page that seems to please a search engine's algorithm in a way that it will rank well for a particular term. The search engine spider, the thing that comes to you automatically and reads your web pages, it saw the gibberish. And when it ranked your web page, it ranked your web page based on that content. But when a human being clicked through, they never saw what the search engine spider saw at all. They saw a page that might be very attractive, might lead them to a sales form or any sort of other kind of material.
Holy cow, Daniel. It seems only a matter of time before search engines become sentient.
Well, in terms of trying to hunt down and eliminate this sort of stuff, they've actually had to be that way for some time. These battles against search engine spammers have gone on almost since as soon as we had our first crawler-based search engine. Google's popularity is in large part because when it started making use of links, it made it harder for people to try to manipulate Google.
And we're talking about a search engine that has 3 billion web documents to sort through. It's an enormous database used by a huge pool of people. So where you stand in those rankings is no trivial matter.
No, not at all. And indeed, if you are ranking well for a particular term and you're in the first page, that can make and break some businesses. And if you suddenly fall off onto the second page, relatively few people will go through.
Something else that Google seems to do, I notice when I use it, is when you put in a few keywords, sometimes some pages will pop up that actually don't have those keywords in them. One that seems to happen a lot, and I guess Ira Glass has to deal with this, is This American Life is actually distributed by Public Radio International, PRI, but everybody assumes it's distributed by NPR. So if you hit NPR and This American Life when you're searching, This American Life's website will come up, even though there's no mention of NPR anywhere in it.
Sure, a lot of people, when they're linking to the site, may be misdefining it by saying this is a great NPR show. And that underscores a problem that we have with the links. They have been helpful in some regards, but at the same time, they can be misleading.
It's been great talking to you. How good is business for a search engine guru these days?
Well, it keeps me busy. There's a lot to write about.
Daniel Sullivan is the editor of SearchEngineWatch.com. Where do you rank on Google when people are searching search engines?
I usually do make it up into the first page there.
Reporters have two default settings. Their reflexive reactions to everything that happens in the world is to be skeptical and critical. So when a journalist actually speaks favorably about somebody, particularly an elected official, the antennae of fellow members of the press shoot up, suspecting naivete or worse, such as an ulterior motive. Joining us now to discuss this is Joe Klein, a staff writer for The New Yorker, and the famously formerly anonymous author of Primary Colors. His latest bit of work is a nonfiction book titled The Natural, The Misunderstood Presidency of Bill Clinton. Joe, welcome to On the Media.
Good to be here, Bob.
You said recently the hardest story to sell an editor or get into a publication is a positive story about a politician.
Well, I was talking about changes in the business of journalism over the 33 years that I've been a practitioner, and I think it's one of the big changes. It was a consequence of Vietnam and Watergate, of course. But over time, the safest sale has been a negative sale. If you write negatively about a politician, you're a member in good standing of the tribe. But when you write positively, especially during a campaign, you are considered to be in the tank. In the year 2000, when I covered the presidential campaign for The New Yorker, I conducted a small thought experiment. I decided to see how positively I could write about the various candidates and still be able to look myself in the mirror. As a consequence, I was accused of being in the tank to George W. Bush, to Bill Bradley, and to John McCain, which represents a wide range of ideologies. I'm kind of embarrassed that I wasn't accused of being in the tank to Al Gore, but I could tell you a lot of wonderful things about him, too. Our natural default position should be skepticism. It should not, however, be cynicism. And over the last quarter century, we've slipped from skepticism to cynicism.
All right. Now, ever the reflexively skeptical journalist that I am, I still have the question, do you happen to be conveniently bringing up this subject just because your book is a very charitable view of the Clinton administration?
Well, first of all, my book isn't a very charitable view. It's a balanced view of the Clinton administration. I give him hell where he deserves it. But I've been on this campaign for a long, long time. I mean, I really do believe that we pose a significant threat to democracy the way we're currently going about covering politics. I think it's made the public a lot more cynical. I think it's driven a lot of worthy people who are interested in running for office away from it. And I think that 100 years from now, when people look back on this time, they're going to look back on it the way we look back on the Salem witch trials.
Okay. Did you see the series by Bob Woodward about what went on in the White House during the course of 9/11 in the early weeks of the war?
Yes, I did.
I think you probably agree with me to say that it was, if not an uncritical look at the administration, certainly a sympathetic one, and I think that almost all involved were portrayed in the most flattering light.
I think that the most clever response to that was from Mickey Kaus, who I suppose you'd call a para-journalist. And what he did was to just cull out the interesting anecdotes. He described them as stray turnips and carrots in a watery soup. There were some really interesting and telling anecdotes in the course of all that tree killing, but I'm not going to go absolutely crazy over this sort of coverage and accept.
I'm just asking you if you rolled your eyes.
Oh, occasionally, sure. But I also rolled my eyes continually when the New York Times did that huge investigation of Chinese nuclear spying, which they later had to retract. I mean, is it possible to roll your eyes while they're glazing over? I think that there are excesses on both sides, but I think the preponderance of excesses are on the side of negativity.
Would you rather live in a world where all journalists were cynical bastards just looking for a kill, or in a world where they just were looking for something nice to say about the politicians because, by golly, they're public servants and they're just doing the best they can?
Well, you know what? Good thing life isn't a binary proposition like the insides of computers, because both of those alternatives are unacceptable and both of them would lead to disaster. But if you back me up against a wall and said, it's one or the other, bub, I would say cynical bastards every time.
That's the answer I was looking for. Joe Klein, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Klein is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest book, The Natural, The Misunderstood Presidency of Bill Clinton, is published by Doubleday and available in a fine bookseller near you.
On Tuesday, the FCC denied a request by the Motion Picture Association of America, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the National Cable Television Association to put off implementing a rule that requires major TV broadcasters to provide something called video description for some programs. Video description is, as it sounds, an audio track designed to enable the visually impaired to enjoy, or at least consume, television by describing what's happening on the screen. The service has been around for years, often used on PBS and most recently every Sunday night on the Turner Classic Movies cable channel. But video description has its detractors, and they're not all in the TV industry. Among those who question its value, in fact, are some members of the blind community, the people who are supposed to benefit most from the ruling. On the Media's Neil Carruth reported on the service a while back. Here's that piece with some updates.
I see dead people.
Watching a film like The Sixth Sense is difficult for Margaret Fansteel, whose vision is limited by a degenerative disease called retinitis pigmentosa. Fansteel is a 68-year-old grandmother of three and a pioneer in the development of video description. She asks you to imagine life with little or no vision.
Turn on your television set to some drama, something like that, that's not very talky, and shut your eyes. You'll find out how much you're confused. Gee, it sounded like they were in a kitchen, and I heard this funny noise and a door slam. Something must have happened, but I really don't know what. Oh, now the music is getting very, very ominous. Gosh, there must be some trouble. What do you suppose is happening?
Well, Cole glances to his left. At the top of a staircase, three people in colonial dress hang by their necks, their eyes open and fixed on Cole. Malcolm peers up the stairs.
Something up there?
He looks up at nothing, then turns back to Cole.
Fansteel first developed description for live theater performances in Washington, D.C. In the early 80s, she applied her technique to television, providing descriptions for the public TV programs Nova and American Playhouse. First, the descriptions were broadcast on a radio frequency, but when stereo TVs became widely available a few years later, video description could be provided on the TV's secondary audio channel, or SAP. Now video description is carried on programs on more than 150 PBS stations. Former FCC Chairman William Kennard believes it ought to be more widely available.
It'll allow more Americans to experience television, which is a tremendously unifying force in our society that all of us should be able to participate in.
In 1996, the FCC was directed to study video description and report to Congress. The commission noted that neither commercial broadcast, nor cable, nor satellite television had taken enough initiative in this area. Therefore, the FCC proposed rules to spur some action. William Kennard.
The market is just not serving on its own the needs of blind people in America. And so it's very, very important that government play an enlightened role to step in and get the ball rolling, get it started.
The rules call on the larger network affiliates to provide 50 hours of described primetime and/or children's programming every 3 months. Large cable systems were required to provide the same service on their top five non-broadcast networks. Currently, Lifetime, TBS, TNT, USA, and Nickelodeon.
Now here you are, the best spaghetti in the town.
He sets a plate in front of them on a little table with a checkered cloth. The tramp licks his chops and they dig in, nibbling strands of spaghetti. He slurps one up. She does too. Tony comes back, playing an accordion. Joe plucks a mandolin.
The new rules were adopted by the FCC on a 3-2 vote. Commissioner Michael Powell, since elevated to chairman by President Bush, opposed the rules. So did the biggest industry trade groups, the National Association of Broadcasters, the National Cable Television Association, and the Motion Picture Association of America. None of these organizations was willing to comment for this report, but their filings with the FCC lay out their positions. They said the 1996 Telecommunications Act did not authorize the FCC to impose these rules. Former FCC Chairman Kennard disagrees.
Congress delegated to this agency the responsibility of making television accessible to people who are blind, and we did just that. I'm pleased and proud that we did it in a meaningful way.
But it's not just the trade groups who oppose the new rules. So does one of the two largest consumer groups for blind Americans, the National Federation of the Blind.
We believe that although it may be nice to have descriptive video of entertainment, it isn't of nearly as high a priority, and we think that the information that is available on television is vastly more important than the entertainment that is available on television for blind people to have.
Mark Maurer is president of the NFB. His organization asked the FCC to start over and place the emphasis on news and information programming. He also raised another issue, whether video description can really describe the video.
You can say, for example, that you have a sunset on the screen. Take a blind person who has never seen anything. What is a sunset anyway? It's a little like trying to describe in written words what a symphony would sound like to somebody who's deaf. I don't think you should try, because I don't think it's practical to do it. I think there ought to be magnificent freedom in putting out pieces of art.
Chafing the glass with his palms, Rick stares into space over the whiskey bottle. He starts to say something, then shuts his mouth and bows his head. His white tuxedo jacket is rumpled. His eyes glisten in the dim light. Picking up the stub of a cigarette, he inhales deeply and lets the smoke drift out of his nose and mouth. The scene blurs and changes to the Arc de Triomphe in Paris.
The Motion Picture Association said the new rules raise First Amendment concerns by mandating speech and the modification of existing programs. Commissioner, now Chairman, Michael Powell agrees that descriptive video is, quote, creative work, requiring producers, scripts, and actors. And his objection leads directly to another industry complaint: that description would cost too much. Charlie Crawford of the American Council of the Blind, the other major blind consumer group, says cost is not a real issue because these technical advances are inevitable.
These kinds of amazing inventions that have happened over the last couple of decades are clearly pointing the way towards a much more inclusive society at a very inexpensive price.
Whatever the price, and in spite of Chairman Powell's concerns, the new rules go into effect this Monday. The TV industry has already sought a court injunction against the new rule, but for at least part of the spring season, programming with video description will be an option for the visually impaired or anyone else who wants to listen. For On the Media, this is Neil Carruth in Washington.
Coming up, all news is good news during spring training. Media people talk about talking about the media, and a concerned citizen with a letter writing Jones.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Spring training, a time to shake off the rust from a long off season, to forget the bitter end to last year's season, and to look forward to the possibility that, by golly, we could go all the way this year. Yes, hope springs eternal before April rolls around. The baseball beat writers covering the preseason can either crush the players' illusions or play along with their upbeat confidence. Drew Olsen has faced this challenge again and again, covering the Brewers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for the past nine seasons, the past nine losing seasons. He joins us from a spring training game in progress down in Arizona. So, Drew, no shortage of optimism down in the Cactus League.
What there is a shortage of is pitching, but there's no shortage of optimism at these camps. You know, let's face it, everybody's unbeaten, unscored upon, and ready to start the season, and so every year, you're right. I mean, teams grade their own paper too high, and when the season starts, you can't hide. 162 games reveals all your flaws, and there's no hiding.
Well, not only do teams grade their papers a little high, there seems to be some grade inflation every spring in every camp on the media side as well.
You know, the funny thing, we were just talking about that in the press room today, that 75% of the teams in baseball have no reason for optimism, so why crush them in the spring the one time of the year that they try to have a ray of hope? But you know, nothing that we write would imply that the Brewers are planning a parade in October down Wisconsin Avenue in Milwaukee and that they're getting sized for World Series rings. We know what's going to happen, and we can see down the road, but, you know, it hasn't happened yet. It is a fine line that reporters have to walk.
And what would happen if you approached spring training in that you chose to bludgeon your readers upside the head with reality?
You're doing them a disservice, I think, because you just squash everything that's going on here. It's almost like, well, why should they read it, and why are you bothering to write it? I mean, the Brewers are playing games. People in Milwaukee want to read about these games. Like I said, everybody here is positive and feels good about what they have going, so the stories just have to reflect that, because never in my 15 years as a sports writer have I seen a general manager come out and say, we are going to stink up the league this year and we don't have a chance. And if it did, it would be page one news, and it would be like a man bites dog, but it just doesn't happen.
Well, because the ecosystem is the way it is, sports writers in the spring in every market function as a sort of, like it or not, de facto marketing arm of the team.
Well, I mean, what other business gets a page and a half or a page of free advertising a day? I mean, there's no question, but it's always been that. And it's marketing for the newspaper. We sell newspapers because people want to read the Brewers. There's that symbiotic relationship between the teams and even covering a Major League Baseball game.
Do you look forward to when spring training is over and you can head north and just ditch the optimism and get back to reality and just start telling it the way it is?
I don't think once April 1st comes that we start becoming more critical, but the stakes go up and the situation changes and the results and the stats aren't forgotten. And I guess in that way, the coverage might seem more critical. But I don't know that as a writer you consciously say you're going to ramp it up and start crushing them just because the season has started.
I guess congratulations are in order, because as of this interview, in the regular season, your Brewers are undefeated.
That's right. Well, we get paid whether they win, lose, compete, or stink. All we cheer for in the media is quick games. We have very simple wants in the Baseball Writers Association. That's pretty much all we need.
Thank you very much.
Hey, you bet.
Drew Olson is a baseball writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome now to Life Inside a New Yorker Cartoon. I'm thinking of the one that ran a couple of years ago, where a television talk show host announces, "Welcome to All About the Media," where members of the media discuss the role of the media in media coverage of the media. I say this in welcoming to On the Media, Washington Post media columnist Howard Kurtz, who also happens to be celebrating the 10th anniversary of his CNN media program, Reliable Sources. Howard, thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much.
One of the big media stories over the past 15 years, really, is the overkill with which the press attacks certain stories that are, you know, particularly lurid. Chandra Levy, O.J. Simpson, JonBenet Ramsey. Now, you've covered this issue to a fairly well on your show. Mm-hmm. Have you been part of the problem or part of the solution?
Well, I suppose you could say if we're doing a show on Monica coverage or an O.J. coverage, that we're just adding our voices to the great din. I'd like to think that we're, at least we're being critical and trying to analyze what it is that possesses otherwise smart and self-respecting journalists to just get totally absorbed in one of these frenzies. And I think it used to be a more of an occasional thing. An O.J.-type story would come along, everybody in the media would go bananas, and now I think we're like heroin addicts. We have to have our fix. So any mini scandal that once would have been treated at a moderate volume now gets packaged and played on cable all day, and it's got to have a logo, and it's got to have music, and it's got to be a kind of a mini soap opera. And I think we all in this business have now given in far too often to this tendency to package and promote and hype stories that really don't deserve it. And so that you have, you know, huge coverage of the war, which is valid, and you have huge coverage of Greta Van Susteren's facelift, which is interesting, but not perhaps as earth-shattering for the Republic.
And how many times has Greta Van Susteren's facelift been mentioned on Reliable Sources?
Only twice, I think, both in semi-humorous terms, but I did notice that she was on the cover of People.
As a matter of full disclosure, I would say that if our program is devoted to any single thing, it's exposing the Fox News Channel for the bastion of hypocrisy that we believe it is, not necessarily on ideological grounds, but on journalistic ones. Certainly one of Fox's preoccupations, if not its central preoccupation, is CNN. But I don't see a whole lot of Fox bashing on your show. Is that by accident? Is it by design? What's the deal?
Well, I don't believe in bashing unless the bashing is deserved. And, you know, if Geraldo Rivera does something controversial, we will certainly talk about it. Do many of their commentators tilt to the right? Do they occasionally engage in sensationalism? Did they interview Tanya Harding after Fox Entertainment staged that ludicrous boxing match between her and Paula Jones? Yes. And, yes, it is part of their shtick. It is part of their identity to beat up on CNN and the mainstream media because they're self-consciously positioning themselves as an alternative to that. And it seems to work for them, and they have a good time, and I have no problem with that.
Okay, so I've disclosed our bogeyman. As we travel up the media heart of darkness and we get to Mr. Kurtz's compound, whose heads are going to be displayed on the pikes there?
Well, I don't have a sort of official Kurtz Hall of Shame. What I do is criticize behavior that I think is excessive. And so I have criticized, for example, the business press for over the years. And we saw this most distressingly in Enron, mindlessly repeating the recommendations and judgments of Wall Street analysts who basically have a financial incentive to be bullish on stocks. I have criticized newspapers and others that don't reveal the conflicts of interest they have when they cover industry issues. For example, in the campaign finance reform bill, there was a provision that didn't get a single word that I could find on broadcast television and hardly any mentions on cable, a provision that got knocked out that would have cut the rates for campaign ads at election time, thereby depriving the networks of a fair amount of revenue. And sometimes I just criticize people who I think do dumb things.
Was there one story that you had to cover that was particularly painful for you because it involved colleagues or friends portraying them in maybe unflattering terms?
Where do I start? One of the most difficult challenges I had was during the 1996 campaign when the Washington Post, just about everybody in political Washington seemed to know, had a story and was sitting on a story about Bob Dole, who was criticizing Bill Clinton on sort of general character grounds. Then Senator Dole had had an extramarital affair some 30 years earlier. There was a great debate in the newsroom about whether that was relevant, should it go in the paper or not. The Post ultimately decided not to print it and said the paper was scooped by the National Enquirer. After that, I wanted to write about how this had happened. The paper was not crazy about that. I ultimately did get the story into the paper, but because it involved the judgments of top editors at the Washington Post, it was just a tough one. It was a tough assignment. There aren't very many people in very many industries who are in the situation of having to go to their bosses and say, I want to talk to you about something you did that a lot of people think was wrong.
Are there times when Howard Kurtz of the Washington Post goes, oh, no, and the Howard Kurtz of CNN's Reliable Sources goes, oh, yeah?
I can't think of one because these two people know each other very well and tend to have the same approach to things. So there's not much anything that I would absolutely not do in the newspaper, I probably wouldn't do on television.
You said probably.
Well, if I say I would absolutely definitely never do it, then you'll go to the transcript and find some example where I did.
In a heartbeat, Howard, in a heartbeat. Well, let's talk about structure and ethics for a moment. Now, you work for the Washington Post and AOL Time Warner. These are gargantuan media organizations. How often does that pose problems for you?
With some regularity, I find myself having to kick these organizations around. But what I try to do all the time is disclose. And I'm proud of the fact, I think I've criticized the Washington Post more in print than anybody else who doesn't work for the paper. I've written about racial tensions, conflicts of interest, bias, plagiarism, and other problems at the Post. I've also written, whenever I write about CNN, there's always a disclosure line that I host a program on CNN. And I think that is so essential to the credibility of anybody who tries to do media criticism. If you just take the approach that you're going to lay off and you're not going to deal with the problems at home because you couldn't possibly be aggressive enough, I think that's wrong. I think people see right through that. And I think one of the biggest problems in the business today is that maybe a half dozen daily newspapers have really aggressive media reporters as opposed to television critics, which are easy. And I think the reason for that is not unrelated to the idea that newspaper editors don't particularly want to be criticized in print, and they know if they hire a real media reporter, inevitably their own conduct and that of the paper is going to come under scrutiny.
Howard Kurtz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Howard Kurtz is the host of Reliable Sources on CNN, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary this week.
And now a few of your letters. On our conversation with the head of the Catholic Press Association last week, Danielle Fontaine had this to say. The Catholic Press's apparent opinion that the interests of the church organization are more important than reporting on events that deeply affect the lives of Catholics speaks to a hypocrisy that exists in all churches. Reverence for a higher being in most religions requires kindness and truth. Yet to protect the machine that orchestrates that reverence, religions are willing to forsake their actual religious duties.
J. Charles Strins wrote to say that he enjoyed John Solomon's report on magazine renewal scams. He had his own run-in with the Minnesota Star Tribune that went all the way to the state's attorney general before the Trib backed down. He writes, "Meanwhile, my 11-year-old was receiving collection notices from Kids Discover magazine. I was in the process of contacting the New York attorney general when the publisher finally responded and took my son off their collection list."
By the way, neither of those two letter writers told us where they live or how to pronounce their names, which brings us to this letter from John Patrick Carroll. "Okay, okay," he writes. "Every week I hear the same injunction. I am finally complying with it. My name is John. It's pronounced John. I live in New York. So stop asking."
Thanks, Joe. For the rest of you, write in to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. And please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
We have a few regular correspondents, but no one so loyal as Reba Shemansky of Brooklyn, who writes to dozens of journals and newspapers. She's also a regular caller on radio talk shows. She is a vehement defender of Democrats, writing some 750 letters over the last 10 years on their behalf in a one-woman attempt to counter what she perceives as right-wing media bias, though she says only about 1 in 10 is published. The New Yorker's Seth Mnookin discovered Ms. Shemansky and wrote about her crusade, and now she's pleased to join us. Reba, welcome to OTM.
Oh, thank you.
How do you regard this practice of regular letter writing? Is it an avocation? Is it a hobby?
I would call it a hobby. Yes, some people play tennis, some people go bowling, some people play chess. I fill my spare time reading political journals and writing letters when it moves me, when I feel it in my gut.
You're in contact with a group of other similarly inclined people, avid letter writers. Are you the most prolific letter writer in your circle?
No. As I said, over the year, I've been exchanging emails with other like-minded people, and I found out that there are other people who get published more often, who write better letters, but I just happen to be in the right place at the right time. That's all.
Now, I know you don't get that many of your letters published, but you do hear from journalists from time to time.
Yes, I do. I kept on writing letters to Martin Peretz, who was the publisher at that time of The New Republic, complaining about Michael Kelly and Andrew Sullivan. And eventually, Michael Kelly was fired. Of course, he went on to bigger and better things, so I don't think it really hurt him. And Andrew Sullivan was eventually demoted. I don't think my letter did it.
But do any of the people that you regularly write to ever write back and say, all right, Reba,
definitely,
knock it off?
Matter of fact, Walter Shapiro of USA Today sent me an email once. He said, am I the beneficiary of all your tirades? And I had to assure him that I wasn't.
You know, I have to ask this question, because going through some of your letters here, some of them are incredibly harsh. Your letter regarding Barbara Olson, who went down in one of the planes mm-hmm. during the terrorist attacks,
yes.
You said she was a hateful, horrible person. She got what she deserved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this stuff would suggest that you're something of a loon.
Well, I would say that in case of Barbara Olson, I always despised her. She would say the most hateful things about Democrats, and then she would say it with a smile on her face. And, I mean, I could say I feel sorry for her and be hypocritical, but I don't. I think she got what she deserves, and let people think what they want of me.
But in terms of the language of some of your letters, this one in the New York Press regarding Russ Smith, you wrote, only a Bush sycophant like Russ Smith could call that lowlife, worthless, ne'er-do-well squatter in the White House a gentleman.
You should see what he writes about Democrats and other people in the media, such as Frank Rich, the deceased Lars Eric Nelson, you know, people like that who don't agree with his point of view. I'm just responding in kind.
Why do you think you've never been published in the New York Times?
I think it's for two reasons. One, because I think I'm a little too emotional, not cerebral enough. And also because when I write to the Times, I'm usually writing criticism, and the Times doesn't like to be criticized.
How do you feel when you're leafing through the papers and you see something and you go, aha, eureka, and you run to your word processor? Is it a great feeling, or are you agitated?
No, I'll tell you the truth. If I write a letter, it's usually I'm pretty hostile, but when I'm finished, I've gotten rid of my anger and I feel terrific.
Do you ever wonder if you have any impact for all the energy you put into it?
I can't really say for sure. People say to me, why do you do it? What difference does it make? Well, one letter isn't going to make a difference. But if there are 100 people that feel the same way and they take the trouble to send emails or write, then it does make a difference.
If you knew for certain that you had absolutely no impact at all, would it make any difference?
No. If it does have an impact, that's great. But this is something I do for my own psychological cleansing. It has nothing to do with making an impact. If I can make an impact, that's wonderful. But let's face it, if I'm going to write to somebody who has a very right-wing agenda, if I'm going to write to John Pohoritz of the New York Post or Michael Kelly, I'm not going to change the way they feel, but I like to give them a piece of my mind, and that makes me feel good.
Well, thank you very much. Reba Shemansky is a partisan Democrat and an avid writer of letters to the editor.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis and Michael Cavanaugh, engineered by Scott Strickland, Dylan Keefe, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Jim Colgan and Lou Alkowski. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.